Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods Market and Deli. Information at bloomingfoods.coop and goodsforcooks.com. Online at goodsforcooks.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Real food, green living.
Real food, green living.
Earth Eats.
Earth Eats.
Planting doesn't just happen one time of year, and neither does harvest.
That's permaculture and gardening expert Jamie Scholl. Today, we'll be sitting down with her and another gardening guru to talk about what to do now that the ground is starting to freeze. I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for tuning in. We also prepare one recipe that will have you reminiscing for warmer days, rhubarb consommé with strawberries and mint. But first, here's Mia Partlow with a look at this week's news.
Numbers prove produce sold big and pizza sauce is considered a vegetable in the eyes of Congress. It's all in this week's food news. Locavores cheered at the news that farmers sold nearly $5 billion worth of local produce in 2008. That number is expected to rise to around $7 billion this year. 80% of sales came from small farms, although the bulk of revenue came from major producers. The farm bill is inching closer to being voted on as the House has been expected to vote this week. Food advocates are still wary of the bill's secrecy, including writer Michael Pollan. In an interview circulated on YouTube, he said, quote, "It should really be called the food bill," unquote. In another blow to making school lunches healthier, the right to call pizza sauce a vegetable was upheld by Congress. The Obama administration had called for less starchy vegetables, like potatoes, in school lunches, and to declassify the pizza topping as its own vegetable. Potato growers and tomato producers fought back hard, and while they cheer, nutrition advocates cringe. You could read more news updates and get the latest in food news on our website, eartheats.org. And be sure to keep an eye on our Twitter feed and our Facebook page. Just search for Earth Eats. For Earth Eats, I'm Mia Partlow.
These days, U.S. farm policy is blamed for a lot of things, even the nation's obesity epidemic. The idea is that billions of dollars in farm subsidies encourage farmers to grow too much grain. Prices drop, food gets cheaper, and we end up eating too much. It seems like a simple equation, except it's not. Reporter Frank Morris of Harvest Public Media has this look at what's really going on.
It's a fact that Americans eat cheap. We spend, on average, less than 10% of our money on food. And though a lot of people, like the patrons of this Kansas City Burger King, are buying too much fast food, it's still a good economic decision.
The smartest, most rational decision is to eat the crappiest food, because everywhere you turn, it's more accessible, more affordable, and more convenient.
Dr. David Willinga at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy in Minneapolis says it's that way by design.
What we've had is a cheap feed grain policy or a cheap calorie policy, and that's been pretty consistent from farm bill to farm bill over the last 30-odd years.
So the farm bill, that big bundle of legislation that includes agricultural subsidies, helps make us fat, right? Well, maybe not. Let's take a closer look at this whole picture.
I'm Ken McCauley. I'm a farmer from White Cloud, Kansas. We're standing on a farm just west of Highland, Kansas.
McCauley says that, yes, he's growing more corn, but not because of subsidies.
The expansion that you're hearing about in agriculture today or for the past several years is all about the machinery and the ease of work. Your work's easier because of technology. Our work's easier because of machinery and technology.
As we talk, McCauley's son, Brad, charges back and forth over the land in a self-propelled sprayer. This thing looks like a monster bug, a green tractor on stilts with booms stretching 90 feet like enormous wings, trailing a finely calibrated mist of herbicide.
It steers itself, shuts itself on and off. So I basically just turn around and make sure everything's running right.
The spray kills everything but the corn, because the corn's been genetically engineered to withstand the herbicide. And for good measure, the corn's also been designed to produce its own insecticide. So now the corn plants grow much closer together than they used to, and weather permitting, produce twice as much grain per acre.
food productivity is more than double, so the real cost is less than half what it was 40, 50 years ago.
Julian Alston is an economist at UC Davis.
That's the big story. And that wasn't caused by subsidies. That was caused by improvements in productivity on the farm.
Farmers are proud of all that productivity, and it has driven crop prices down. But productivity aside, surely farm subsidies themselves make food cheaper. When the government picks up part of the cost of something, the price should go down, right? Julian Alston says, not necessarily.
What's wrong with that line of thinking is that it doesn't pay attention to how actually farm subsidies do work.
You see, subsidies are not the only way the government influences farmers. Some federal programs do make crops cheaper. Things like subsidized crop insurance and other traditional price supports make food more abundant and reduce prices. But some policies actually increase prices. In that category would be getting paid not to plant. Some farmers get federal money to let land lie fallow. That cuts production and raises prices. Another example would be tariffs. There's a tariff on imported sugar that tends to boost the price of all sweeteners, including corn syrup. And ethanol production, which is supported by a federal mandate, now buys up about 40% of the corn crop, again, raising prices. Julian Alston has done the math on the whole thing.
The net effect of the whole set of farm supports is to make food more expensive and actually to discourage obesity.
So farm subsidies really have nothing to do with it.
Robert Parlberg, who teaches political science at Wellesley and Harvard, has tried pointing this out.
You almost never get any interest in trying to make the counter-argument. People assume that you're a crank if you dare to challenge what everyone knows to be true.
But there are some obesity experts who agree with Parlberg and Alston.
I'm very concerned about how hard it is to eat well in America today.
Margot Wootan is the director of nutrition policy at the Center for Science in the Public Interest.
Our food environment has evolved in a way that it's almost perfectly engineered to promote or cause obesity.
And Wootan says that environment isn't shaped by farm policy nearly as much as it is by food processors and marketers. Even when corn prices doubled, the price of corn flakes barely moved. That's because ingredient costs are minuscule compared to other expenses. On average, less than $1 in $5 consumers spend on food actually goes to farmers and ranchers. Shipping, packaging, processing, marketing, and selling make up the rest of your grocery bill.
Companies are really competing very aggressively to try to sell their food instead of somebody else's food, and that's promoting more and more food that Americans are eating, and as a result, we're gaining a lot of weight.
So the obesity epidemic in this country is driven by lots of factors, and U.S. farm policy probably doesn't play a big part in the problem. Frank Morris, Harvest Public Media.
You can read and listen to more from the folks at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. We're picking the brains of a couple experienced gardeners today to talk about what to do as the temps start to get colder and the ground begins to freeze.
Oh my goodness, the title. I'm still working on that one. But my name is Jamie Scholl.
We'll just go ahead and call her president of My Edible Eden, through which she offers gardening and permaculture advice and also sells a series of planting calendars for the various climate zones. So I posed the question to her, what should gardeners be doing now to put their gardens to bed for the year, prepping them to hibernate over the winter?
I'm one of these strange people. It's like when someone asks me, can you teach the putting the garden to bed class? I'm like, well, because I usually don't typically put my garden to bed. I utilize it all the time.
So like right now in her garden, she's planted bok choy, Jerusalem artichokes, sweet peas, kale, cabbages, and believe it or not, her tomatoes are still producing. She planted all these cold weather crops in August and September, and she hopes to be harvesting off them for the next few months. She scoffs at the notion that folks in the Midwest can't eat locally year-round.
Now, you won't be able to eat all of your food possibly as fresh, but it is possible, especially if you're going to preserve the harvest, whether it's drying, smoking, canning. There's a lot of different options. Freezing, it depends on how energy intensive you want to be.
Eating preserved foods is one thing, but is she really picking fresh food from her garden when there's snow on the ground?
You can. I have. I've harvested carrots before, the covering of straw. The straw will insulate. So a straw is hollow in the center, and that is like insulation. It provides a lot of, think of a straw bale house. That's an amazing amount of insulation there, more than a typical house. So if you cover your root veggies with this, you'll easily keep the ground from freezing and then be able to harvest. They'll actually be very sweet and much more tasty.
We'll hear more from Jamie Scholl in just a bit when she'll field questions from a novice gardener. If you didn't plant fall and winter crops, you can still work in your garden this time of year to amend the soil for next spring. Farrell Johnson of Abundant Harvest Farm says this is key to getting good plant growth, especially in southern Indiana. Gardeners seem to have a love-hate relationship with the clay-based soil around here. On the one hand, it contains plenty of nutrients. On the other hand, it retains water and can easily become a swamp. Johnson doesn't mince words when he's talking about what it's like to grow food in this area.
It was literally some of the worst soil I've ever seen.
He was specifically referencing the soil by the district, Monroe County's Solid Waste Management and Recycling Facility. He installed a 9-foot circle garden with radishes and turnips just feet away from the recycling bins. He's anticipating this will be a successful public garden, so it's obviously not a lost cause, growing food in clay, but it does take some preparatory work in the fall.
The ideal thing to start right now is to till in 2 to 3 inches of quality compost into your garden, and that will help replace the nutrients that have been taken by the plants.
But he says gardeners should also think about planting cover crops.
To really amend, I would suggest a cover crop of either white Dutch clover, crimson clover, hairy vetch winter is also a good cover crop. Them are legumes, so that will add nitrogen back into the soil.
In addition to amending the soil, cover crops also protect the soil from erosion, which is just as important.
You don't want bare soil. Even if a person has to put straw all over their garden or something, I would always recommend some type of protection for the soil. It never should be left bare. It'll erode and you'll really lose the nutrients that otherwise you could have kind of kept in that location.
I have a personal question. Okay. So I grew tomatoes this year and they didn't ever really bear fruit. I had a lot of leafy greens coming off of these tomato plants. So I really want to have successful tomatoes next spring. Help!
And just from the what you kind of mentioned, it sounds like it could have had too much nitrogen in the soil. If it's too much nitrogen, you won't have the it won't go into the fruit cycle properly. And what I've noticed a lot of times is people want to go organic, but they'll either use too much nitrogen or just nitrogen without the phosphorus and potassium and the trace minerals.
So what can I do now to make sure that spring is going to be great?
Without me really looking at the soil, it should be at least dark and kind of have a dark matter look to it. So in this area, it's a complete total clay base. So in that clay base, you're not going to have success unless you actually amend the soil, and that's where the compost comes in. What you want to do is amend it, and then it actually becomes a living system that really starts compounding on itself. All the micronutrients and the microorganisms are really made available to the plants.
You can learn more about the products and services offered by Farrell Johnson through Abundant Harvest Farms on their Facebook page. Just search for Abundant Harvest Farms.
So with tomatoes, this is what I'd recommend.
And that's Jamie Scholl again.
Create a raised bed in whatever manner. Have your soil conditioned where it's light and fluffy and aerates. You can put your tomatoes in early if you want earlier tomatoes. Make them cherry tomatoes. Those will ripen earlier. But put it under a hoop house. So in your raised bed, make it a larger raised bed. Put your PVC pipes on it. Cover it with plastic, and then you'll be able to get it warmer in there. You'll have to watch for ventilation if you're going to be as rudimentary as that. Or you can just go ahead and invest in a greenhouse for $1,000 or $2,000.
As a novice gardener myself, I'm not going to be investing in a greenhouse anytime soon. And I'm still obviously a few months away from putting tomatoes in the ground. So what about the plants that are currently growing? This is where Lee Bush comes in.
So here we are out in the garden, and I've got garlic on this side. I've got my cold frames right there. I've got two cold frames.
She's a grad student in the food studies program at Indiana University in Bloomington.
So what I'm going to do is try and spread straw all over the places that will be exposed to the winter air. And then I can show you what's going on inside my cold frames if you like.
Yes, please.
Okay.
The cold frames are basically garden beds enclosed on all four sides by 2x4s and then covered with a clear lid to enhance the light and energy coming from the sun. She had help building the first cold frame, but made the second one all on her own, and she refers to that as her first success in the garden.
This frame was built from leftover wood in our house, and the shower curtain was from a friend who was going to take it to Goodwill. And I was thinking, oh my gosh, I bet I could staple that to the frame and put it on top, and it'll function like a greenhouse. So we're going to see how it works. I've got some pretty sturdy vegetables in here, and I actually have a whole row of sprouts of seeds I planted that I don't know what they are.
Fun.
And it's the middle of November, and I'm like, oh, you can make it. You can make it. Just, I wish I knew what you were.
No.
In addition to the mystery seeds, she has kale and turnips and spinach in the beds. The turnips and spinach especially are going nuts. But she's worried that they're starting to crowd each other.
Because I broadcasted those seeds and they're doing so well, I don't know how much I'm willing to thin them. Because they look so delicious, but I don't want to stunt their growth. So as a novice gardener, it's the one thing that I'm really curious about is when to thin and when to let them go on their own.
They may end up growing together, which, you know, fine. And some of them may die, or they just grow closely. Or you could just harvest them now and have a baby spinach salad.
Bush also wanted to know about laying down straw in her cold frame. Will this help the plants survive better, or will it actually make them too warm?
Now, snow insulates, so you're going to have it around 32 degrees, and it depends upon how frequently you want to eat from it. So what you're growing now, or had been since August, is what's going to be eaten on. Now, the plant will not die. It will slow its growth, so you want to keep the plant alive and eat what is there. But it'll be okay. Just make sure it's covered. Otherwise, put the straw on. But it needs the sunlight.
And the other question is that I planted a bunch of garlic, and I planted a bunch of garlic maybe a month ago, and it seems to be doing really well, and I see all the green shoots. But all the other garlic that I planted maybe a week or two ago, I'm not seeing anything from it, and I'm wondering, I'm not sure if I waited too long or if it's just real slow because it did get colder over those last 2 weeks and it's just going to be sort of dormant throughout the winter.
Yeah, you can plant garlic a lot of different times of the year. I mean, I know some farmers nearby who will plant it all the way up into December. Your harvest time will be different. The size of the bulbs may be different depending upon when you harvest them. So it's about a 10-month cycle for garlic, so I wouldn't worry. It'll be fine.
Jamie Scholl's website is myedibleeden.com. Thanks to both her and Farrell Johnson for sharing their knowledge about gardening in the cold months. And best of luck to Lee Bush as she nurtures her plants this fall and winter. We'll give you updates as she lets us know how it's going. Read more and see pictures on our website, eartheats.org. We'll finish off our day today with one recipe. Chef Daniel Orr has some rhubarb from his garden and strawberries that are almost on their way out.
So we're going to kind of do a deconstructed strawberry rhubarb pie. Except for we're going to turn it into a soup instead of a pie. But we're going to have those wonderful flavors. The rhubarb, of course, nice and red. That's going to give us a nice color. And basically what we're going to make is a consommé. Which with the rhubarb, and then we're going to pour it over the strawberries.
Okay, define consommé.
Well, consommé is a clear, kind of a clear soup. This will be more like a syrup because it's sweet. So we're just going to rough chop the rhubarb. And you only use the stem. The leaf is poisonous.
Don't eat the leaf.
All right, so don't eat the leaf.
Put that away.
All right, we're going to pour the rest of the rhubarb in there. Then we've got some aromatics that we're going to put in. We've got some cinnamon stick. And cinnamon stick, I always like to just break it a little bit, and that will bring out more of the flavors. We've got some sliced ginger, some white wine, about a cup and a half. We've got about a cup of sugar, and we're going to add a cup of water. And we're going to bring that to the stove, let it boil, and then let it sit for about a half an hour, and then strain it off.
Chef, what What is this? Candied orange peel?
Yeah, that's a candied orange peel. We're going to put that in as part of the garnish. And then we've got some mint, and then we've got our wonderful strawberries. Okay. So while the syrup cooks, we can put the strawberries in the bowl.
What do you suppose it is about strawberries and rhubarb that just go so well together?
Well, I think it's the acidic flavor of the rhubarb with those nice, sweet, sun-ripened strawberries. You know, just kind of a match made in heaven. And again, this is not a real Annie dessert because there's no chocolate involved.
There's no chocolate in it.
And again, this would be great with a rhubarb sorbet or vanilla ice cream. Would be perfect. So let me just get the syrup and we'll finish up.
Great.
Delicious. See the recipe and salivate over some photos on our website. While you're there, check out recipes submitted by our bloggers, like Sarah Kaiser's sugar cookies with pumpkin puree. And the news bloggers are keeping up with the latest from Washington about the farm bill, as well as news from farms around this area as they prepare for Thanksgiving. Join the conversation at eartheats.org. Special thanks to Chef Daniel Orr, Jamie Scholl, Farrell Johnson, and Lee Bush. Liz Leslie and Sarah Gordon write our news stories. Sia Africa and Ayabon Binder keep the website in tip-top shape. And a big thanks to you for eating local, living sustainable, and supporting those of us who do the same. Till next week, I'm Annie Corrigan.